The title of this collection, Occasional Magic, comes from a story told by Vietnam veteran Larry Kerr. It's about his intense love for a young woman named Omi, whom he describes as, quote, smart, meltingly lovely, and strong, with a fierce belief in the possibility of occasional magic, end quote. Occasional magic refers to those moments of beauty, wonder, and clarity, often stumbled upon, where we suddenly see a piece of truth about our life. As Moth directors, we spend our days helping people shape their stories. We help people identify the most important moments of their lives. As we sometimes put it, quote, the moments when you became you, end quote, so the audience will understand why they mattered so much. All the stories on these following pages were first told in front of live audiences. They showcase the great range of humanity, from a 15-year-old kid saving a life in Chicago to a Russian facing down the KGB and cover all seven continents. That's the opening of The Moth Presents Occasional Magic, true stories about defying the impossible. What is The Moth, you may be asking? Well, if you're familiar with WBAA's weekend schedule, The Moth is aired weekly. It's a storytelling program where you'll guess we're about to embark on journeys into the sublime, into the laugh-out-life funny, into the macabre, and into the thought-provoking. You'll be rewarded with success if you do have these expectations, for these written stories are almost as engaging on the printed page as they are when told orally in front of those live audiences. The opening story, always start out your book with something really catchy, right? Well, the opening story carries us back to New York City in the summer of 1979. A big city secretary steps out for lunch before an interview to become the daytime talent director for TV network ABC. And back in 1979, being the talent director, the daytime talent director for any network would have been a big deal. Well, she's stepping out for lunch, and she is assaulted by a pair of street popular mimes. Spoiler, she not only gets revenge on the mimes' assaults on her, she gets the promotion at ABC. They're not necessarily related, but it's kind of nice that she concludes her story by letting us know, yeah, I went through all this junk with the mimes, but in the end, I aced that interview. I got the job. The very next story takes us into 1980s Israel, when a young boy discovers his rumpled, macho man of a father is, wait for it, not the everyday workaday dad. No, the boy's father, he discovers, is the fabled 42nd bank robber, a svelte, smoothly operating thief whose acts of robbery are wrapped into a whirlwind of 40 seconds. This guy is a man of towering national pop fame. And he turns out to be a father possessed of a bit of an over-the-top macho man personality. The storyteller, remembering back to his boyhood, is now a father himself. And as the story comes to its climax, has sweet revenge on both his dad's disappearance from his life. His dad was arrested for all those robberies and convicted, sent to jail. And for any number of robberies and his macho father's fanatical interest in making his young son a man's man, with this fetchingly tender response to his own son's oh-so-2000s take on gender roles. As the author tells us in writing from that oral presentation, my dad was the Elon Musk of the stick-up job. And later, I learned how he did it. And it was incredible. To rob a bank in under 40 seconds, he'd take the money at gunpoint, then run out of the bank, jump on his motorcycle, and drive around a corner, up a ramp he had custom built, and into a van where he would pause. So here's a seminal existential question of bank robbing. Where's the last place you would ever look for a bank robber? And the answer is, the last place you would ever look for a bank robber is inside the bank he just robbed. So my father would take off his jacket and his helmet and tuck the gun back into his pants. He'd calmly walk out of the van and around the corner and go back into the bank, which at that point was a crime scene, crawling with police officers. One of the police officers would inevitably run up to my father and say, "You can't be here, sir. This is a crime scene." And my father would give him this dopey look and say, "Oh, can I just please make a quick deposit? My wife will kill me if I don't." The police officer would say something like, "Sure, but be quick about it." And my father would walk up to the bank teller, deposit the same exact cash he had stolen 3 minutes earlier. This being then, computers were still kind of new. He made the cash virtually untraceable. Well, as I said, he got caught. He goes to prison, disappears from his son's life for all intents and purposes, except for one weekend a month when he got out on kind of a temporary parole. Fast forward to the current day, and our storyteller tells us, from time to time, my dad still comes to visit New York, where I live with my family. And in one of those recent visits, he and I are sitting in my living room, not talking, as men do. And my son comes prancing into the room, my 3-year-old boy. Now, that boy looks exactly like me, just as I look exactly like my father. And if there's one thing in the world that boy loves, it's his older sister. And if there's one thing in the world that his older sister loves, it's Disney princesses. And in prances the child dressed like Princess Anna from Frozen. I look at my son, and I look at my father looking at my son, who, by the way, looked amazingly good in this light green taffeta with a black velvet bodice and some lovely lacing. And I know that my father is judging me. But you know what? I don't care. Because at that moment, I realize, strangely, that by going to jail when he didn't just free me from the burden of this macho nonsense, he also freed up my son to grow up as a happy boy who can pretend to be whoever he wants to be, even, or especially, a pretty, pretty princess. And I can't tell you how grateful I am that instead of going through life mindlessly as two tough guys, my son and I are free to become whatever kind of real men we want to be. Well, the stories just continue. The next story crashes us into war-torn, small-town, South American nation of Colombia. We move ahead a bit. We're now in the 1990s. And a young dental school graduate is swept up into a revolutionary evening of terror, forced at gunpoint to perform dental surgery on a revolutionary commander's critically ill son. Her fear, trepidation, and ultimate resolution to treat the scared young man is riveting. As the pages pass and the stories continue to delight, we meet up with the deservedly famous singer, songwriter, author, Roseanne Cash, who takes us into a journey of self-discovery in the oft-mentioned in these pages, New York City. There's a surprising cast of characters, characters that include the weather and a politically inclined friend of hers, that offer both her and us readers an ultimately uplifting tale of surprise in the big city. Hint, watch for a surprise appearance by Vice President Al Gore. And so we travel the world. We travel through time, turning the pages, trekking around the globe. The introduction assures us we'll visit all 7 continents, you may remember, traveling both backward in time and forward to the present day. The authors of these tales, as you may have surmised, are accomplished artists, holders of college degrees, and everyday people as well, with extraordinary life experiences to share. In other words, this is a collection of authors, of storytellers, of varied backgrounds, educations, certainly interests as well. I hope you'll not only read these gripping stories, None of them are more than 3 or 4 pages in length, by the way, so you can pick up, put down this book after an appetizer, or hang on for the full course. Read the stories, yes, but please do read the introduction and the preface as well, kind of an odd suggestion, for it is in the preface and the book's introduction that you'll pick up some advice for your, for our own efforts at storytelling. From the category of it's never too old to learn, our foreword tells us, quote, I chose a story from my adolescence, which to me remains a startlingly vivid time. I tried hard to memorize all the parts of it, but in the days leading up to the big night, whenever I banished my husband from the living room and stood there with a timer practicing, I found that I was leaving out entire chunks of the story. I started to panic. Then I realized that instead of focusing on memorizing, I should focus on memory. I simply remembered the experience of being at summer camp in the 1970s, feeling young and excited and open. And once I really felt it all over again, I found the words. They weren't the exact words as during my last rehearsal, but they weren't supposed to be. A moth story is like a living thing. It changes. It moves. Finally, on stage under a spotlight in front of an enormous audience, I was like a better coiffed, much older version of that girl I'd been at camp. I would say to anyone who is thinking of getting up on stage and telling a story, what you need to do most of all is feel like yourself. Once you do that, the words will come. And also, as it turns out, the applause. I left the stage gratified, hot-faced, exercised, thrilled, thinking I would do this again. Heck, I would even do it wearing a special storyteller cloak. Great advice, I think. It's a book that rewards us as readers in some truly surprising ways. For after all, the foregoing advice that you can carry into your conversations at work, at school, with your family, with friends, or in a room filled to the brim with strangers, with maybe 2 or 3,000 strangers. Yes, The Moth may be a rather nondescript-looking book with its rather dully colored red cover. Granted, a golden moth is embossed on its front. But within its pages, I know you'll be dazzled. You'll be moved to fear and joy. You'll be taken, as I was, on a tumultuous ride through human experiences. Experiences you can't help but remember. I want to finish with this from, of all places, the introduction, because it gives yet another great insight into why this is such a fun, interesting book to pick up and to read through. As Catherine Burns, the artistic director of The Moth, tells us, quote, we will forever try to live up to the way British writer and moth storyteller Lem Sissy described the feel of moth evenings. Quote, imagine the moth to be an encampment in the desert. Take a seat. Someone will make a space for you. It's dusk in the land of story. What's happening? Who knows? Someone's going to stand up and speak? Something about their life. Something that means something to them. Something that may mean something to you. The sun dips and fires. Rising stars spill across the sky like shoals of silver fish. You see, there are as many small fires as there are stars. This is not an encampment. It is the world. The air is perfect body temperature. It is. The moth is by the people, for the people. That's you. End quote. For more than 2 decades, tens of thousands of people have shared stories on moth stages around the world, and millions more have shown up with open hearts to listen. If the warm response of moth audiences assures us of anything, it's that empathy is alive and well in the world, and for that, we have a reason to feel hopeful. It's a special kind of nondescript book that you're likely to overlook if you're just walking by it on the aisles or on the bookshelves. But I hope you will pick this up. I hope you will just begin to read. Pick any particular story. It doesn't have to be this one or that one. Just open the book up. Let it kind of settle into you and let it start getting those little gray cells clicking in your mind. I think you're going to like this as much as I do. The Moth Presents Occasional Magic, True Stories About Defying the Impossible. It's available at all of our fine libraries who wouldn't want to have this on their shelves, including the West Lafayette Public Library.